WNBC, in cooperation with the United Nations, presents People at the UN, another in a series of programs dedicated to talking with people who work in and out of the great complex of buildings that is the United Nations. We again invite you inside the UN, so to speak, where we shall be talking with some of the people who help to further the cause of this great and dedicated organization. In a sense of public spirit and dedication to the causes of the UN, we're delighted to welcome Miss Celeste Holm, star of Broadway and Hollywood, who will act as hostess for People at the UN. Now, Miss Celeste Holm.
Thank you, and good evening. Tonight, it is my great pleasure to talk to Dr. Ralph J. Bunche, Undersecretary for the Special Political Affairs at the United Nations, top-ranking American in the United Nations Secretariat. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, Celeste, and thank you very much.
I can't
tell you. It's nice to be here with you.
Thank you. What a pleasure this is for me. I have known you in the sense that we first met when there was a tribute paid to you in Los Angeles.
Yes, I remember. Shrine Auditorium.
Oh, indeed.
Right after the elephants, wasn't it?
Well, I think the circus had been there the week before. And it was a marvelously moving experience for all of us who took part in it, because they went back to your school days at the University of California.
At Los Angeles.
At Los Angeles. At UCLA.
UCLan.
And told us about your activities on the basketball team and how much honor and what high hopes they held for you then. Well, do you feel, when you were back there, as you look back and remember, I don't mean in the night of the tribute, I mean when you were in school, did you have any idea what direction your life would take then?
I can't say that I really did. I liked school, I liked college, I liked the activities, I liked the kids, and I was having a good time. I had to work hard in studies and outside to sustain myself. But I enjoyed it, and I didn't have much sense of direction. As a matter of fact, in those days, most everyone, including members of my family, thought I was going into law. And
is that what you majored in?
Well, I was pre-legal, what they call a pre-legal political science major. And up until graduation, it was just assumed I was going into law school. But
happened to make the change?
Well, when I came up to graduation, I had to sort of look ahead for the first time, you
see,
and give some thought to what I was going to do and where I was going. And I decided that I really had no liking for the law, no impulse in that direction. And I had a chance for two graduate fellowships, one at Stanford and one at Harvard, and I took the one at Harvard and went into graduate school, not really knowing just
where
I was
go.
Going, leading from there. But I knew I'd be in school and studying and
what were you majoring in there?
Government.
Mm-hmm.
And then, quite by accident, I landed in teaching. There was a young professor from Howard University, who was a chemist, as a matter of fact, not in the social sciences at all, doing some graduate work at Harvard, and he wrote to the dean at Howard University about me. There's a young fellow up there in government who might have some promise, and I was offered a job, and that really determined the direction of my career.
Did you enjoy teaching?
Yeah, oh yes, very much. I should say more than anything I've ever done. I thought it was the most rewarding, not in terms of finance, of course, because it's not very rewarding in finance, especially in those days, but in terms of satisfaction through contact with people.
And seeing the emergence of ideas.
Now I'm reaping some pleasant reward from my teaching days, because now you see some of my former students who have matured and are making very fine careers, highly successful careers. Most recent is Hobart Taylor, who's just risen to a quite high governmental position in Washington. And I go around and I see these fellows doing well. And, of course, I like to delude myself in thinking that well, I had something to do with it.
Well, you know, you're making a point that I was going to ask a question about, which is, I think, as I have observed and listened carefully, it seems to me that whether we are aware of it or at the time or not, there are perhaps one, maybe two, and if we're very lucky, three people in our lives who, as we look back, had a deep and lasting and constantly influencing role in our lives. And I'm sure that for those students that you've mentioned, you have played such a role.
Well, I would hope
so. Who would you say did it for you?
Well, I would say offhand that, and I think this would be, this would stand up after closer and more thoughtful inspection, that there were three main influences in my life. First, my maternal grandmother. My sister and I lost our parents when we were young, and we were brought up by my mother's mother. She was a tiny little woman, very high-spirited, very religious, deeply religious. She taught me certain basic things to guard against excessive pride, but still to have a sense of dignity and self-respect, and never to let anybody cause
threaten
you to lose
that.
These. Yes, that's any threat to these you had to react strongly against. And this was not just on a racial basis. I remember one incident when I graduated from high school, as a matter of fact. And I suppose this was one of my early experiences with the more subtle aspects of a racial attitude. I'd run into prejudice, of course, inevitably Detroit and Albuquerque and Los Angeles. But on graduation, an official of the high school, who was a very nice man and wanted to be very friendly, but he made a quite unfortunate remark in the presence of my little grandmother. He said to her, "You know, we're so proud of Ralph, we have never regarded him as a Negro." And she, in a very quiet but very emphatic way, told him in so many words that she was certain he didn't understand what he was saying, that he was casting a slur upon the group, that she and her grandson were very proud to be Negroes. And he apologized and it was all right, but it didn't strike me at the time, you see, but...
No. You say there were three.
Yes. The second one would have been my fifth and sixth grade teacher in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I had a very great pleasure of honoring her last winter at the National Education Association. They have an annual award. You get to name the teacher who in the elementary grades who has influenced you most, whom you feel most indebted to, you see. And I named a teacher with a wonderful name, Miss Belle Sweet. She's still Miss Belle Sweet. She's in her 80s now, uh-huh. Little old lady who lives up to her name in every respect. But I had her in Albuquerque, and in her treatment of me, I was the only Negro in the class. She conveyed to me a sense of identity, of communication on an equal level, of acceptance, of equal treatment.
And like, valuing you as an
like
individual.
Like I had never experienced in any schoolroom before. And from the day I walked into that classroom, I remembered that. It certainly strengthened me. And when this question came to me, after all these years, because this was back in 1914, you see, her name of all the teachers I'd had came to mind immediately. And the third one would have been very recent in these last 9 years, and that was Dag Hammarskjöld. You see, I had the very great privilege of working directly and closely with Dag Hammarskjöld, whom you knew
yes.
very well, for 8 years. Mm. And this was truly one of the world's most remarkable men. And the experience of working with him, of talking with him long hours over the day, of seeing this uncanny mind work, because he was the most unusual man that probably ever existed, because he was a sheer intellectual, almost an arrogant intellectual, you see. But he had what most intellectuals lack, and that is a political sense, and a sense of political timing and tactic that was amazing, truly amazing. And a courage and integrity that was just beyond words, and a devotion and dedication. Well, I've often said that he gave a new dimension to the term dedication. And so from this I gained very much. This was the most enriching experience, I think, I've ever had in my adult career.
Well, you say that you considered him primarily an intellectual.
Yes, and he thought in these terms, and he was...
Yet he had an enormous degree of feeling for everyone.
Yes, but he was a great reserve, you know, and he didn't take very kindly to weak minds.
Sentimental thinking.
Yes, that's right. He was austere in his intellect, you see, and demanding, and high standards.
I think one of the reasons that he was so successful was perhaps the fact that he did demand so much of himself.
Yes.
That other people could hardly do less.
No, that's right. He would never ask you to do anything that he could not do.
Well, then you say you were teaching. And then I want to know how from there you got to the United Nations.
Well, it's like my whole life, Celeste, is accidental. I mean, I was just always falling into things. Never, no planning. This was the most unplanned, undirected life, I suppose, that there's ever been. And, direction was an afterthought.
I don't quite believe that.
Yes, that's
true. In the sense that the pattern
because
must have been
there.
Because
I told you how I fell into teaching, you see, and... that led me into marriage because Ruth, you know, my wife, was in fact one of my students. And
I didn't know that.
Yes. Where we really got acquainted was when she came up one time and protested very vigorously about a grade I'd given her, which I didn't change. And I admired her spunk and her spirit, and also had noticed before that she was not difficult to look at. And then the war came. I taught at Howard, you see, my career there ran over 18 years, actually. And I was called into war work just before Pearl Harbor by one of my scholarly friends, Conyers Reed of the University of Pennsylvania, who's now dead, noted historian, who knew me as a social scientist, and I went into OSS, Bill Donovan's outfit. You know, Donovan had the ambition to get professors in the front line somehow, and he set up this organization and recruited a lot of us. And I've been in this sort of public service work ever since. I never got back to teaching, but I sometimes have a nostalgia for it.
You don't ever feel that it's certainly related to what you're doing?
Well, yes, certainly, because I know, of course, that I couldn't be holding up in what I'm doing if I hadn't had the sort of preparation not only school gave me, but the enrichment and the maturity that I got in the classroom. I think that was probably the best education I ever got. If a teacher is open in the classroom, then that becomes school for him. And he learns a great deal, not only academic things, but character things,
You know, you're quoting what a very well-known psychiatrist once said to me. I asked him where he had gained the insight which made it possible for him to help other people. He said, from my patients.
Yes, yes, that's right. I can understand.
And you're saying really exactly the
yes.
same thing.
Yes.
Well, I am curious as to how you evaluate, or if you can evaluate, the talent for mediation.
I don't think I can, Celeste, frankly. Hard put to try to define it. Certainly, you know, some of the ingredients from experience. You've got to have enormous patience, endless patience, but also to be able to break it off when it's time to break it off, or when it's timely or expedient or helpful to break it off, because sometimes too much patience
leads nowhere.
Leads nowhere. You've got, above all, I think, to be able to keep calm and cool, or at least not to show reaction, nervous or angry reaction, no matter what provocation.
Yes, that I can see that the students would have helped a great deal.
Yes, because a teacher can't be much good either if he's losing his temper in the classroom. But finally, I would say the most important thing is somehow, and how one does that, I suppose, varies amongst people and in situations, to win the confidence of the people you're dealing with. Not to have them like you or even to be friendly to you, but to trust you in the sense that they are convinced that you will play it straight, that you are exerting every effort to be impartial and objective, and that you're not trying to play any tricks on them.
Does it help you to imagine yourself in their shoes?
Well, you know, sometimes I thought when I've been in these situations, maybe it's an advantage not to be too smart. Because if they get the impression that you are too smart, they may be a little dubious.
This is why I was curious about your calling Dag Hammarskjöld an intellectual, because it's a funny thing. I don't happen to feel that to call somebody an intellectual is a pejorative or calling him a nasty name. At the same time, the idea of pure intellectuality somehow is related to me to the idea of, it's like pure mathematics.
Yes.
It's almost removed from an emotional plane.
Yes.
And I think it does frighten people.
Yes. In Dag's case, you see, I would say that his pull on people, his strength, would be primarily in the fact that people would almost inevitably be so impressed by this man's personality, strength of personality, by his obvious honesty, even though they might be awed and even might react a little bit to intellectuality and would find it difficult, as many did, at first to well understand him, because he would often talk over people's heads.
Do you remember your first conference with him?
Yes, I do. I was promoted by him, and he met me in the corridor one day, and he said, "We're reorganizing, and I want to keep you very much, and I'd like you to be an undersecretary in an undersecretary spot. But frankly, I don't know whether it's going to develop in such a way that I can put you in there." Well, I was impressed by this because he was so utterly frank and open and obviously honest and earnest about it that I think if he hadn't found a spot for me, I...
You would have been heartbroken. Yeah. And then you came in day-to-day contact with him.
Oh, yes, because he brought me what we call over there upstairs on the 38th floor very soon, and then we had a very close relationship on all of the tough problems, Suez and Palestine and atomic energy and Congo and Lebanon, Jordan.
Do you find when you are going abroad on some actual mission that people want to talk to you and find out what you think?
Yes, I should say and I know you've experienced it, the only disadvantage of having your name before the public or being in the news or being known, being seen on television or something, because you find it so difficult to ever get alone, to be with your own thoughts. Because on the job, you see, you get so little opportunity to think. I often say, well, we're just working, we're never thinking, because we don't get time for problems come. You have
funny
to deal
phrase.
With them with a minimum of thinking. And it's wonderful to have a chance to just relax and think. But you get on a transatlantic plane, settle down, you say, well, now, this is a wonderful opportunity. They can't reach you by telephone. You haven't got any work with you. And you'll think a while, read a book.
The lady sitting next
relax.
To you.
Somebody very soon...
Starts sounding just
said,
like me.
Yes, would you... would you tell me about this or that problem in the UN and on the agenda? Or what do you think of Khrushchev? Or so on. And you can't really do anything about it because I don't think anyone should ever be rude, even in his own protection, as long as people are nice and decent. These are innocent people, and they're interested in... So then what you find yourself doing is becoming a missionary and selling them on the UN.
Well, that's exactly what leads me. That leads me perfectly into the next question I wanted to ask, which was, in all your travels and from all these questions that I'm sure you've been assailed with right and left, what do you feel are the most important aspects of the United Nations that people should know about?
Well, I'd say that what is most important, if we could, and we haven't found how to get it across to them, is for people to realize that the UN, the General Assembly, Security Council, more than legislative body, the UN is passing resolutions, which are the substitute for laws in the international community, that these bodies are dealing every day with questions of more vital interest to the future of every individual on Earth than anybody in the world, you see. But how do you get this across to people? Because they see it as remote, and, you know, they read about debates and fights. You see this in the visitors that come to the UN, most of them. You see they're very interested, curious. But I'm not sure they take it. I think most of them don't take it very seriously. You know, it's something to see, like this building.
Yes. I see.
But you see, I'd see people taking an attitude toward the UN like they do toward the city council or the state legislature or the Congress and denouncing it. They're doing that with regard to the Congress or the state legislature or the city council in the sense of possessiveness. This is ours.
Yes.
You see the point?
Yes.
This is ours. We have a right. They ought to do better. They do wrong here and so on. Not that it's something that's far away and that they can be detached about, but something that they can feel personal about. This is. I'd be happy if they would be denouncing the UN on these terms, because then...
You'd have them involved.
That's right. This is the thing. This is the word. That's it, to get them involved.
Our time is running out.
Well,
I'll tell you one thing. Mm. I think everybody feels very personally related to you.
Well, Celeste...
And I think that's one of the best ways of keeping everybody involved.
Well, I've enjoyed sitting down here and talking with you, because I think you are delightful.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's been my great pleasure and honor to talk this evening with Dr. Ralph Bunche, Undersecretary for Special Political Affairs at the United Nations and top-ranking American in the United Nations Secretariat. This is Celeste Holm inviting you to join me again next Saturday evening when I'll be talking to another of the interesting people at the UN.
WNBC, in cooperation with the United Nations, has been proud to present another in the series of programs, People at the UN. Join us again next week for another program devoted to talking with more of the people who, in their own way, help to keep the work of the United Nations functioning. This pre-recorded program was produced by Gary Stradling. Your announcer, Jack Costello.